at unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Monsters Under the Bed, Part 2.
This morning, we talked about basic meditation, and as Claudia said, basic in the sense that it's fundamental, because any kind of internal work requires a certain ability or capacity for clear, stable attention. And in many respects, or in some respects, you can regard resting meditation as like scales and music. You never actually play scales in a concert, but the more you practice scales, the better your musicianship becomes. And it's very, very much about building capacity. This afternoon, we now begin to the content topic of the retreat, Monsters Under the Bed. And we're going to use a certain framework for this, which actually comes from the Four Noble Truths. What's the problem? What's the genesis of the problem? What's the solution, and how do you do it? So this afternoon, we're going to be focusing on the problem, and George is going to start off with that.
Yeah, I was going to say it's amazing how we think alike, but maybe it has more to do with the fact that you trained me. I was going to start with the Four Noble Truths too, since that's where the Buddha started. Why not? What is it that causes the confusion and struggle in our lives? It's separating ourselves from experience and then reacting against it or reacting to it. So, I mean, the second noble truth is the cause of suffering, of struggle, is thirst, tanha, craving, thirst, that thirst that can't be satisfied. But I think that's really shorthand for thirst or pushing. It's either grasping or pushing something away or ignoring. Those are the three ways of reacting. There's infinite varieties in those three ways, but going back to the body again, it starts with sensations. We're sitting there, we're sitting here, we're sitting in our bodies. We can feel the weight of our body on our cushion. We can feel the movements and sensations of breathing. We feel warmth or cold. We feel hungry or full. We feel tired or jumpy, whatever it is. There's a cluster of sensations, movements of energy in the body. One or more of those sensations, we suddenly decide we don't like. We feel it's happening to us. Or we like it. And we want to keep it going. So the first sign of the struggle is an impulse to grasp something or to push something away. Or if it's not one of those, it's, it doesn't matter, I didn't even notice it in the first place because I'm just got tunnel vision. So the emotional dramas, the stories, the beliefs, the character stuff that we kind of cement down comes afterwards At first, there's an impulse. There's a physical impulse coming out of the body or moving in the body, a movement of energy. And you can call it attachment and aversion and delusion, or you can call it craving and ill will and ignoring. But I like to get even underneath those words. What does it feel like to see something, to feel something that you like, and there's just that impulse to reach out and grab it, to keep it, to bring it, control it? Or something arises you don't like, before you even think about it, way before there's stories and thoughts or emotional dramas about it, there's an impulse to push it away or to back up, to get away. Ignoring, the impulse to ignore, is a little harder to notice, but it too has a physical sensation to it. It has an energetic movement to it. It's the movement of collapsing in, losing the sense of space in the room, or the sense of space and movement, the vastness of my body, the fact that the kink in my neck can hurt over here, and yet my legs are pretty relaxed today because, there's a lot going on. There's a vastness. When we ignore something, we close down to something, and everything else disappears. So one way of working with this, rather than wrestling with the emotional dramas and the thoughts and the beliefs and all the stuff that gets built on those impulses, is to notice the impulse itself when it arises. In a sense, you're not doing it. It's certainly nothing you decide to do. It's something that arises inside. It's something that happens, a movement of energy. Again, it's reaching out, grasping something you like, pushing something away you don't like, or ignoring. And then there's the reaction builds on that. It cascades. There's additional reactions, like something you don't like, impulse to push it away, a belief that you ought to get used to it or you ought to learn to like it, so then you start reacting against the impulse to push it away, and then you're kind of simultaneously feeling guilty and resentful that the whole thing's happening, and then you got to deal with it, and the thing just, that's where we get lost in it. But if you can go back to that original impulse to grasp or push away, it's kind of the counterpart in action to returning to the body, feeling the sensations and movements of breathing rather than arguing with yourself or worrying about emotions and drama and thoughts. Just going back to the body, going back to the sensations and movements that are driving those thoughts and emotions. So confusion, struggle is caused by the impulse to react to what we experience. What is it that we're trying to do? What is it we're trying to get by reacting? Something happens we don't like. We want to get rid of it. Something happens we do like, we want to hang on to it. If we try to hang on to something, we're ignoring the fact that everything changes. Some things change faster than others, but everything changes. Sensations, feelings, thoughts arise, they pass away. Some of them don't pass away fast enough for us. So we're basically fighting the fact that everything changes. It also works the other way. The things we like, we want to keep them around. So we're fighting the fact that everything changes. We want that sunset to last forever. Or we go on retreat, and at first it's horrible, and we just want to get out of here. But by the end of the weekend, we're sort of liking the simplicity of it and the fact that we don't have to answer the phone, and suddenly now we want it to keep going. So we're fighting the passage of time, the arising and subsiding of feelings, sensations, events. Another thing that we're struggling with is to get our emotional needs met. Whatever they are, or whatever we think they are. Another reaction is to survive, and to build a sense of self in relation to meditation practice or to a relationship. So Ken and Claudia will be talking about emotional needs, trying to get our emotional needs met, and trying to hang on to things, make things solid. But I'd like to focus on the change. Change and impermanence is, in traditional Buddhism, it's not very popular in Western culture, but in traditional Buddhism, probably the number one formal practice is contemplation on death and impermanence. You need some basic stability of attention, some basic mindfulness to be able to do that. So you learn, Ken said, you build some capacity in that first. But then often the first practice that you do for a period of time is on change and impermanence. And of course, the big one for humans is the impermanence of our lives. But that's not the only, if everything depended on the moment of death, as some Buddhists have it, then I have trouble with that myself, because I have a hard time being inspired and focused and maintaining motivation for some theoretical moment that's going to happen in the future. But change is happening constantly, happening in our bodies, happening in our emotional experience, happening in our thoughts, happening in the world around us. We tend not to notice it. We grasp after what we like, try to hang on to that. We push away what we don't like, try to get rid of it as quickly as possible. And we ignore the basic fact of change, constant but irregular change that's actually taking place. That our experience arises due to causes and conditions, a few of which we have some influence over, and it subsides for the same reason. Causes and conditions fall apart. You can approach it philosophically like that and then go through your life systematically trying to find things. What actually lasts in my life? Some things last longer than others, but what is actually dependable, reliable? It's going to be there forever. Try to find something. That's kind of a contemplative or philosophical approach. But a more immediate way, and one that might be more useful in the context of the practices for this retreat, is to notice those impulses, those reactive impulses as they arise. At the moment, they arise in the body. The actual sensation, the movement in the body, of pushing away or grasping. Start with those. Begin to notice those, how they happen moment after moment with practically everything that arises in experience. We like it and we grasp it, or we don't like it, we push it away, or it doesn't mean anything to me, so I'm going to ignore it. Watch those impulses and see how many of them are an impulse to do away with time, the passage of time, the flow of things, whether slow or fast, whatever the causes and conditions of things arising, occurring at the moment. See how many of those impulses are to try to fight that. And for now, I think just, notice the impulse rather than go to philosophy or try to change the impulse. But since my theme is usually the body, to actually notice, acquaint yourself with that process and keep it as visceral and physical and not concrete, but real in the sense that it's actually something arising. I have an impulse to continue talking, but I think I won't.
Thoughtful of you, but Kim chooses to stand sometimes because of her back.
As George mentioned, one of the other reasons that we tend to react impulsively is to get our emotional needs met. We live in a culture that force feeds us on a continual basis the line that you not only should get your emotional needs met, but if you're not getting your emotional needs met, then something's wrong somewhere. So we put that expectation into all of our situations in our life, into our relationships, our marriages, our friendships, even to our children sometimes, into our careers, because what the undercurrent for many of the activities we're engaged in is, well, I'm not in this career just because I want to do this job. I'm in this career because I get my emotional needs met by doing whatever it is I'm doing. So the interesting thing about emotional needs is that the patterning that comes from that line, those patterns are usually and very often familial patterns that are set very early in childhood. I think the research says somewhere around the age of 3, you have patterned how you respond in certain situations. You've patterned your tone of voice, how you work with people. All of that comes out of that family environment. And of course, life happens to us, trauma happens to us, and so additional layers of emotional needs and get layered on top of that as we grow and experience life. But those emotional needs get turned into scripts and stories. And it doesn't take too much often to trigger them. And the response becomes a very automatic response, very impulsive. Something happens, and with really no thought or intervention, that pattern just kicks in and starts to run. And I'm sure all of you have had the experience of having responded in that way, very impulsively, in sort of an emotional state, and then later on stepped back and said, yeah, why did I do that? Why did I say that? And then there's all this internal talk that goes on from that, like, I shouldn't have said that, and what will happen from that, and all of that. But in the moment, that script just kicked right in. And along with those emotional scripts are sort of core dramas. You know, we often move from one pole to the other to get our emotional needs met. So in one moment we'll be a certain way where it will draw attention to us and feed our emotional needs to make us feel good about who we are, that we're doing a good job. And in the next moment, we're creating a problem. And any of you who work with people know that generally you favor one pole or another. And so, you know, why is it that some people are labeled problem people? There's always issues around those people over and over again. So the real challenge that we have is to try to build up our awareness so that we can begin to experience what is underneath those emotional scripts and those core dramas that we carry around with us. When you look, and I think if you do take the time to start reviewing the aftermath of those experiences, they're the cause of pretty serious suffering in most of our lives. And they create the kind of difficulties that we carry around with us for long periods of time. And it's one of the aims of our practice to begin to really penetrate and to bring and shed light on some of these core patterns and the way that they run, and to begin to cut into those emotional behaviors. I mean, how much energy do we put into caring about what other people think about us and into whether they care at the level that we want them to care? Our emotional needs tend to drive a whole lot of our activities. And a lot of the time, they're completely below the level of awareness. It's not an easy process to engage in this. Ken always calls it out straight out. This is not about making you feel good, and it's not about making your life better. But it is about waking you up so that you start to build awareness when you're in one of those built-in emotional response patterns, so that you can begin to actually cut those patterns so that they don't run so unconsciously, so automatically. Emotional patterning and responses to our emotional needs tend to kind of fuel a lot of the choices that we make in our life and the expectations that we carry around with us. And it's very painful when we're sitting and feeling that those needs are not being met and our expectations aren't being met. And it can even move into our practice quite easily, actually. Because we bring some of those emotional needs directly into our practice, and our expectations about what we should be getting from our practice and how it should feel when we practice, all of those are tied to our emotional needs and what we expect and hope that our practice will bring to us in terms of fulfilling those emotional needs. And when that doesn't happen, and there's tremendous suffering and despair, and my practice isn't working, I'm not doing it right, something must be wrong, because I'm not getting from it what I want. There's a story, one of the Nazarene stories. Nazarene went to the minaret to do the call for prayer. And shortly after he did the call, he was seen running like mad away from the minaret. Somebody called out to him and said, "Nazardeen, what are you doing?" Nazardeen turned around and he said, "That was the most penetrating call to prayer that I have ever done. And I'm going to run as fast and as far as I possibly can so that I don't have to hear it." And that's what happens when we hit one of these emotional patterns. We don't really want to hear it. We don't really want to feel it. We don't really want to experience that struggle. And so we run. And the place we usually run is straight into our head and into our thinking. And we start analyzing it and thinking about it and dissecting it and what should I have done differently or what would make it better. And none of that ever really cuts to the heart of what's going on. The difficulty in our culture is that even as parents, I know my parents definitely did it, and I'm sure that I did it with my own children, people build in the expectation that, you know, you're this special person and therefore your emotional needs and everything you need in life should be given to you. And I work a lot with parents today, and I am stunned by the extent they will go through to meet every emotional need that that child has. Every emotional need. It's incredible to me. And the children become very adept at getting them met. If one path to the parent doesn't work, they've learned many roads to get those needs met. And I've seen parents literally just kind of throw up their hands with the child completely acting out, completely out of control, in total tantrum, demanding some crazy thing like, "I want to go to McDonald's and get a meal," or whatever. And the parent will just simply go, you know, like, "What can I do? What can I do?" And the aftermath of that for the child is actually an incredibly painful life. Because when they grow up, nobody's there like mom and dad to meet those emotional needs. And I think if we all examine, you know, what we've carried forward in terms of expectations for life, that wanting and insisting and constantly driving to get those emotional needs met is part of the driving force of this impulsive behavior that just starts to run sometimes. That we feel those needs are important, they're part of who we are, and that we deserve to have those emotional needs met. So coming face to face with that and beginning to examine those is a pretty serious loss and a pretty painful process to begin to work with that. And that's why this retreat is, we had you sit this morning to try and really get a strong base of attention, because dealing with monsters under the bed, they're monsters, and this takes some hard work. And you know, we're here to provide some tools to do that. And we begin by exploring some of the reasons for our impulsive behavior. I think my time is up.
George started off talking, providing a general framework first, and then talking about making things last. And we have a lot of instances of that. As he mentions, one of the things we try to do is make our life last. I just really enjoy the quote by a writer called William Saroyan, who said, "We all know that we're going to die, but I really thought an exception was going to be made in my case." And a lot of us, that's sums up our way of approaching life. And then Claudia talked about emotional needs. I'm going to get this clipped on so I don't have to hold it.
What will you fidget with if you don't hold on?
I'll find something. And I've done a fair amount of executive coaching and business consulting. And one of the things that I come back to again and again is that many, many people's careers are completely established, particularly in the entrepreneurial realm, by their desire to, or their need or whatever, to complete some kind of relationship. And it's pretty standard fare that if you're a venture capitalist and you want to determine whether an entrepreneur is going to be successful, the number one question you have to ask is, what is your relationship with your father? And if he says, "I get along with my father," you don't invest in that guy. Because he doesn't have anything to prove, you see. It's the single most reliable predictor of entrepreneurial success, is tension in the father-son relationship.
I think it should be rich.
What happened?
So,
what about women?
I'm not an expert on that, but I see it again and again in women. There's one way that it manifests is they do not want to let go of the relationship with the mother. They want to make it last forever. And there's a great deal of fear. We also have this in men as well, of without that, but it's a little more, I think it's a little deeper in women, because women come from, they have the same body as their mother. They're very, very much connected. And so I find that over and over again. But I just give that as one example. And as far as I know, it holds for women too. If they have tension with their father, they're much more likely to be effective in building businesses and institutions. Don't know what it's like with a mother. Doesn't usually come up. But that's another whole field. I don't want to get into it. So we titled this retreat "Monsters Under the Bed" because there are these things lurking within our psyche which are determining very large swaths of our lives, and we have no idea that that's running. I'll give you one example. As a student of mine many, many years ago, who, when he was 18, this was at the height of the Vietnam War, joined the Marines. And he ended a couple of tours in Vietnam, and when he described what it's like to be in combat in Vietnam, it's just like, I just couldn't imagine it. But when he was doing the meditations on death and impermanence, one of the meditations is to take a look at how your relationship with life and your worldview changes in the course of your life. So you do it at about 5-year intervals. And he came in for one meeting with me. He sort of sat down in the chair and said, "I never knew." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, my father died shortly before my 18th birthday, and he was a Marine. And it's just very clear to me now. That's why I joined the Marines. It was to keep that connection." And he had no idea of it, that was what was going on at the time. And that was a very large chunk of his life. He had written 3 novels to get the Vietnam experience out of his system. And we come up with many, many examples like that. So the question is, who's actually living your life? What's actually living your life? And is it the desire to make something last, as George was talking about? Is it the concern to get old emotional needs met, things that were laid down in the past? Or is it the concern, which I'm going to be talking about now, to be somebody? Now, as Claudia pointed out, our culture really conditions us. I like what she said, that if you're not getting your emotional needs met, then something is wrong with you. And this is just, from a Buddhist point of view, so mind-blowingly insane, you can't really take it in. Because all of that stuff's in the past, and there's no possibility of actually getting it met because those people aren't around anymore. All you can get is some imitation of it, and a lot of people do that. But in our culture, the idea that you are to be somebody, and Claudia also said, you're special, so you're being conditioned that you are somebody special, starts very, very early in our lives, and that if you aren't somebody special and unique, etc., then again, there's something wrong with you. This is an incredible burden to lay on people as a way of defining their lives. And it comes up again and again. I won't say enjoying, but slightly puzzled with an odd mixture of bemusement and horror in myself. Because having taught for so many years, every now and then I think, somebody talks to me, I said, they shouldn't talk to me that way, I'm a teacher. And I've noticed this little idea, I'm somebody. And as I say, bemusement and horror is the how I go, what's that? Yeah. But I look at it and I go, what's that doing here? And go, okay, so try to do something with that. I'll be quite straight with you. I'm not entirely sure what's going on, because one of the things I've become very interested in are the different forms of conditioning that work on us. Now, most of us are quite used to familial conditioning, which really sets up a lot of the emotional patterns. And as Claudia said, that's usually well set in place by 3 years. In fact, an awful lot of it is laid down in the first 6 months. It's a little frightening. Any of you who are into attachment theory know about that. And then you spend the rest of your life dealing with those first 6 months. I mean, my favorite line on this is one of my students came in to me and said, his 16 or 17-year-old son once said to him, "Dad, you just made a huge mistake in parenting. Do you know how much therapy I'm going to have to go through to work through this?" And the student said, what do you do when your son says that? And I say, here's what you say. You look at your son, you say, "You're right. I really screwed up, but it's your problem now." And he said, "I can't say that. That's no..." But in addition to that family and emotional stuff, Largely through my business work, I've become aware that there's a very significant component of conditioning, which I'm going to call sociological. And that is that the way we behave and the way we act in certain situations is very largely dependent on our role in those situations. So that if we are a worker bee, you're going to come in and behave in certain ways. And you'd usually form really good connections with your other workers and think, they're doing it to us again. And you get nice cohesiveness and you have fun, but you always feel slightly oppressed. And then if you're in middle management or a middle-level conditioning thing like that, it's like, nobody loves me, I'm all alone, and nobody understands my position, and I can't get anything done, and I'm full of fear because they don't like me below me, and they don't like me above me, and it's just a mess. And then if you're in the top position, or in a senior position, it's like, don't bother me with all that stuff. You don't know how much I have on my plate. And, you know, so I don't have time for your little problems, because I'm trying to do this. And you get authoritarian and demanding of people. And a lot of these behaviors are totally unproductive. And the amazing thing is, if you take those same people, put them in the same position, but in different roles, their behaviors will change completely. Just like that. And so you take the person who is in the top position, you put them in the bottom, and you take the person who's in the middle position, you put her in the top, and they behave differently. And we actually see this in revolutions. You know, in the beginning of when a revolution is getting going, everybody is like, oh, we're all together, you know, and they're oppressed and things like that. But as soon as the revolution is successful, what do you get? Turf wars, and they all start fighting with each other for influence and who controls the government now. So that's another whole level of conditioning, and it's all about who we think we are. So that's this notion of being somebody is something that we carry in us. It's something that is reflected back. I mean, it's the first thing most people, at least in L.A., want to know. Who are you? And you know, and if you're not somebody, then why am I talking to you? And it's quite ridiculous. I had a very, I won't say pleasant experience with this, but I was at a dinner party once, and we were having a very involved discussion, and it was quite substantive, etc. And then somebody asked, well, what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a Buddhist teacher. Nobody listened to a word I said after that. That was it. I was out of the discussion, just like that. I thought, well, that's very interesting. Well, it says a lot about how people perceive Buddhist teachers. That's changed. That was a long time ago. I had a very different experience recently because I was in a networking group, and somebody said, well, what do you do? I do executive coaching. They said, well, that's, everybody does that. What do you actually do? I said, well, I also do a Buddhist teacher. Oh, that's really interesting. So, and you just get this stuff coming up all over the thing. So one of the things, and I'm going to go into meditation instruction in a minute, but where, you know, how does this being somebody, how does it manifest in your experience? And, I'm torturing Claudia this weekend by making her tell stories. So, and she's doing a great job. But I love working with stories. So it's a very short story about Nasruddin, about being somebody, and he comes into a bank. Wants to cash a check. And the clerk says, do you have some ID? Nasruddin puts his hand in his pocket, takes out a mirror, looks in it, and says, yep, That's me. Okay. Before I go to the Q&A, just a few comments about meditation, what we want you to move into now. George talked about impulses and how impulses originate in the body. And what he said about, we see something that we like, and there's actually a physical reaction. Most of us don't notice it, but there's a leaning towards or reaching out or trying to take. And when something comes up that we don't like, there's another physical reaction that takes place. And it's very, very fast. It's like, or depending on the strength of the reaction. And Claudia talked about the emotional needs and how deeply they're ingrained. And I've talked a little bit about being somebody. So, I don't want you to get into an analytical frame of mind. We're all have enough exposure to psychology that we can do that very easily. I want you to go through the body. And this is really, really important. Take some situations, relatively recently, or they can be big situations long, some time ago, but I like to work with stuff that's like maximum a month old, usually within a week. So the memory is relatively fresh. And a situation where something took you over. It doesn't have to be a big thing. Maybe it only took you over for, 5 minutes. Maybe it took you over for 5 hours. Maybe it took you over for 5 days. Explore it. But don't explore it in terms of trying to figure out what it was that took you over and how that came from your childhood, and it's all because your mother hung a spider in your crib. Just forget all of that stuff. What were the physical sensations? What were the physical sensations that arose? Now that's going to involve you bringing the situation to mind, replaying it relatively slowly, and observing what happens in your body. You're not going to have the actual physical sensations because it's a memory of the experience, but you are likely to be able to detect an echo. That's sufficient for our purposes. And when you're able to detect that echo, then just rest with it. One of the things that has been coming up in the interviews, and when those physical sensations come up, include them in your awareness. It's not so helpful, actually, to put the attention right into that place in your body. It's better to keep a sense of the body as a whole and include those physical sensations or the echo of those physical sensations. Now, if you don't know how to keep awareness of your body as a whole, my suggestion is that all the time you're meditating, you keep an awareness of the soles of your feet and the top of your head at the same time. No, I'm not very good at this stuff, so I like to reduce it to really simple things. That gives me a better chance at doing it. So if you're aware of the soles of your feet and the top of your head, you're naturally aware of everything in your body. So anytime you're getting lost or distracted, go back, soles of the feet, top of the head. And then you just are aware of the physical sensations. And they may be relatively faint, and that's fine. And just rest in that experience. Replay the situation again. And now that you're in touch with the physical sensations, they'll be a little clearer. At some point, you may get some emotional sensations as well. And that's fine. Include that in your awareness, in your attention. When you can hold the physical and the emotional sensations together, and we're just including more and more here, you may find, possibly to your surprise, that you can rest there. One of my students just before the retreat emailed me and said, this is, because I'd given some similar instructions, he said, this is so weird, Ken. I've got all of these disturbing emotions flying around and I can just rest in them. I wrote back, very good, keep going. And not only that can you rest there, you may find that you also begin to relax without actually doing anything about all of that stuff. And what happens, not all the time, is that as you actually begin to relax, one of two things happens. You either get a much clearer experience of that situation, so now you go back to the beginning and work with those physical sensations and those emotional sensations. And that's very good, because now you're moving deeper into all of that material. Or you get a glimpse of the monster. And the glimpse of the monster is that it's some kind of understanding. Oh, that's what I was doing. Which is usually accompanied by feelings of nausea, shame, etc., etc., etc. Like, I can't believe, how could I be doing that? And tomorrow we're going to start talking about how to, well, different forms those monsters can take and so forth. But that's the idea. So let me review that again. You're going to let your mind settle. Just resting in the experience of breathing, as we talked about this morning. Recall a situation which was troublesome for you in some way. And when I say troublesome, maybe you got really excited and so full of glee and so enjoying things that you completely forgot everybody else around you. Did anything happen to anybody? You get carried. We can get intoxicated by glee and excitement and success and good fortune just as much as we can get depressed and angry and despair and so forth. So, recall it. Start sensing the physical sensations, including them in your awareness of the body as a whole. Then include the emotional sensations and see if you find some rest in the experience, not bringing it to the experience, but in the experience itself. See if you find some relaxation. See if you find some understanding. And this is not an intellectual process at all. It begins with the body, and it is all about sensing, and as we talked about this morning, listening deeply. Okay? So with that, we can open it up for questions. Anita, microphone here.
Probably have to turn it on. what happens when, I'm trying to rest and here all this analysis starts to come in.
Go back to your body.
That's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just go back to your body. When that analysis starts up, you go, okay, what am I experiencing physically? It may take you several tries, but the analysis has started up because there's been a physical movement away from all of that stuff. So you go back to the body. Microphone there.
I'm having trouble understanding what you mean by a glimpse of the monster if that's not some sort of analytical insight.
A very good point. It may be, you can leave the mic on so it doesn't click on and off. It may be exactly the same understanding that would have come through an analytical process. But when it comes through this process, it arises as an experiential understanding, not an intellectual understanding. So you may have been able to figure it out, but the way that it arises, and because it's an experiential understanding, it carries a hell of a lot more weight in terms of actually changing things than just an intellectual understanding. George, you want to add to that?
Yeah, a concrete example of that is knowing that smoking is bad for you. You can even look at pictures of, smokers' lungs, etc. But imagining that you're going to get cancer or reading the medical literature, even if you actually believe it, you understand how cancer grows, etc., you don't stop smoking. It takes something more than thinking or reading or hearing before it actually allows you to be willing to go into the sensations of craving. Smoking's not the problem. Something's making you smoke. My sarcastic responses to people are not really the problem. What's happening that makes me, do that? Something's happening before that. Until I see that and see the whole horrible chain of it, knowing that I'm sarcastic isn't going to change my behavior.
Good. Other questions? Raquel? Nicholas, could you pass the mic back, please?
I have an ongoing gap in my understanding about trying to get my emotional needs met and how that's a bad thing or something that I'm
it's just resistance is futile.
I mean, I understand it when the examples are, with some examples, and then there just seems like so much gray where there's a part of my just who I, my aspirations and motivations and wanting to connect with people, and that gets really confusing for me around that. And it's just been one, it's not just today, it's very ongoing. And even how it's layered with the expectations piece, like it seems like, when there's a household and there's an expectation that the kids are gonna go to college, they just go. And it just seems like there's some benefit. And I know it's probably my own, I feel very hardwired around this one.
Well, first of all, an expectation that somebody go to college, that's a little bit different than saying, for example, you know, my life was so much better, or I didn't get to go to college. I was deprived of college. I don't want that to happen to my child. Therefore, you will be going to college. What that builds in is an expectation for that child that emotionally he must go to college to meet the expectations of the parents. And that's when you have college students committing suicide and dropping out and all kinds of problems and ramifications from that. So, you know, we have to be careful in the language that we use in terms of expectations. But emotional expectations that you take into relationships and friendships and all of that, and the desire that you're working with, what your work is and what all of our work is to move into the experience of what that feels like, what that needing feels like, and to go and really rest in the body and fully experience that needing so that we can get in touch with what's driving it.
I'm going to go a little further. In Claudia's example, your example of college, is a very good one, because one of my old friends up in Canada used to be in the registrar's office, and a student came in, and or potential student, and was rejected for some reason. And he just sat down in the office. He said, "I can't go home." And he just didn't move, and the thing was 6 o'clock, it was time to close the office, and he just said, "I can't go home," because he hadn't been accepted. So rather than trying to figure it out intellectually, which I suspect you might be doing, anything that comes up, experience it completely in just the way that I described, so you know what it is. That way you don't have to figure anything out. You follow? If you try to figure it out with this, you know how far you're going to get? Okay. If you figure it out with this and this, what's going to happen? Ah, you got the tools then. Good. All right. I think I heard the dinner bell ring. Have a good dinner. See you at 7 o'clock.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.